Yeah, it is crazy. So, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun. You have Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And, we've been reading through the newest Gary Renard book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we're maybe about halfway through now. I don't know. We're getting up to the...
More than halfway. Yeah.
Okay, good. We're getting up to the scribing of the course. So this is good stuff. Just a minute to talk about that lesson from today, lesson 153. Mm-hmm. And how hard, you know, it used to be just, it seemed insane to me. I kept thinking, oh, you know, one of these days this is really going to be that I'm going to be, you know, be able to be defenseless and not be always on my guard and always, you know, willing to and ready to attack based on my rightness and your wrongness. you know, it shifts your whole point of view when you recognize that, you know, Jesus really just wants us to brand friends, and he doesn't want us to be at war with each other. And in fact, he's in the lesson itself, in all these lessons, he is just begging us to put down the weapon. Uh-huh. You know, put down the weapon and come with holy open hands. Put down your weapon of being right and look on your brother and see that he is the same as you. And we're just all children playing in the sandbox, and you know, none of us can hurt each other. It's, you know, we're playing a game that we always will win, and there's no reason to be afraid. So, you know, it's one thing to give up your grievances and turn to your brother in love. It's another thing to take a responsibility to be among the teachers of God and to be that representative of Jesus, which what he did, all he did was go around and shed and share his love. So he didn't attack. He didn't defend. In fact, he was the most defenseless. Jesus was total defenselessness. And you see where that got him. So, you know, that's probably not a good idea. You know,
I think that's, again, our tendency to equate behavior with what the Course is talking about, which has nothing to do with behavior.
Right. But it's true. I mean, he didn't. You know, he didn't say when they said, you know, you think you're this, and he said, well, why do you not? Why don't you think I'm this? Or of course I am. Or, you know, he says, what do you think? This is what he said to people. What do you think about this? Who do you think I am? What do you, you know, he didn't, you know, get on his big righteous high horse and say, yes, you know, I'm direct communication with God, and he's telling me that you are wrong. No, he never said anything like that.
Well, I think that Socratic approach continues in his course that we now have available in the last few decades, that, you know, it keeps asking us, you know, do you really think that this world is going to do it for you, you know? There's no demands, but it is extremely commanding because it's a commanding presence that summons us, you know, calls us out of our deep slumber of believing that this world is going to do something for us. And not that we need to diss the world, but we just need to see that it's not effective. It's just, its efficacy is nil. Nil and void.
That's right.
Well, the classical phrase is null and void, but it's that too, you know, it's a zero. It's a nothing. How could something that doesn't exist deliver what we really are and want, which is the same thing? You know, it just ain't gonna happen. But it's only after we seem to have exhausted, you know, all the permutations of it. But he's saying, well, do you like in chapter 31? You know, do you think you really need to travel down all the roads of all the alternatives that, you know, the world offers? And he says, you know, there is a real alternative that, you know, instead of waiting till your back is against the wall and you've, you know, created a nightmare that you have no alternative but to choose the real one left. Why not, you know, make it a little easier for yourself and, you know, look at the inner saboteur that tells you that this world is capable of delivering something you truly want. And, you know, and just say, you know, I'm not going to listen to that anymore. I'm just going to notice what that blather is as it goes across the screen on the ego's ticker tape, and just say, you know, that's an interpretation that I'm now learning to question. That's the Socratic approach that says, you know, maybe, this world is a massive hoax, a holographic facade that we made up and then thought we threw away the key to the projection room and thought that, you know, there was no recourse to you know, a victim script that appears to have been foisted upon us by outside forces. And you say, no, none of that's true. It's just a big projected dream that we took seriously and forgot to laugh. You know, how silly is that?
Yeah. Exactly. And my biggest, the thing that really blows me away every time I start getting caught up in those kind of things and thinking, well, this should be that way and he shouldn't do that. And you know, who told you that? Who told me that? Who told me this is the way things were? What thought system said that? And when I start looking at it, I think, well, you know, all of this came out of this need for defense, this fear and need for a defense. Mm-hmm. And that's what told me. Something told me I'm weak. Something told me I'm in danger. Something told me I am small. Something told me that I need to protect myself. I need to defend myself. And, you know, who told me that? You know, obviously not someone who knows, because this is Jesus is someone who knows, and he's telling me the opposite. So it's now time to, and it's not something you can just do all at once, I don't think. You know, maybe some people can just say, you know, I'm no longer going to listen to this world, and I'm going to only listen to the voice for God. And you know, I've said that many, many, many times, and look how where it's got me. But, you know, it really has got me somewhere, because the willingness to do that, the willingness to say, I might be wrong about this. What they told me might not be right. What I told myself might not be right. You know, who told me these things? And, you know, what is the real truth? And as, you know, as you go through and you start looking at things that way, or for me anyway, I realized that I was believing a lot of nonsense, and it wasn't helpful to me or anyone else. All it was doing was causing me more fear. So, yeah. You know,
Like you say, we can be afford to be gentle with ourselves, because it generally is a slow process. But at the pace that we can't even realize, we're quickening it by the little willingness that we, you know, eventually fan the spark of that little willingness into a bonfire that consumes our investment in insanity. and pretty soon, you know, at some point we look back and say, wow, you know, that persistent willingness to, you know, when I have had lapses and in thinking, and, you know, was trying yet another approach to make an illusion satisfy me, and discovered it wasn't cutting it, that became further motivation to be more mindful and in a gentle but strong way to, you know, that's the fun discipline that really is liberating, freeing is to see that, you know, once you begin to get that momentum going, you just want more and more of that awareness of peace that comes from letting go of the enemy to peace, which is really the saboteur that we made up that appears to have, you know, presented us with a hopeless situation. But the real hope comes in seeing that voice is part of a made up persona, made up identity, that we call our little s, our seemingly separate self. Little less self, and that it really is just a shabby substitute for the capital S self that we all are and share, that A Course in Miracles calls the Christ, and other names, you know, and it basically says that that the voice of that is the Holy Spirit and our inner kindness teacher's promptings, however we want to refer to that, become our way out of a hellish dream. But it's just a silly nightmare that we don't need to take seriously, and we learn to take less and less seriously as we go along, right?
So. Yes, absolutely.
Is there anything? Would you like to read lesson 153 or parts of it? Because I found it really, you know, super helpful.
Oh, I would love to do that. That would be pretty dang awesome. And I have it. Let's see, where is it?
Should we just read a paragraph and just go through it?
Sure. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay, I can start off if you want.
Okay, go ahead, please do.
Okay, so this is lesson 153. If you're doing the calendar daily lessons and following along on the acim.org website or in your book or wherever, this is the one that is aligned with the calendar and our dream of time. And it's in my defenselessness, my safety lies. Lesson 153. You who feel threatened by this changing world, its twists of fortune and its bitter jests, its brief relationships and all the, quote, gifts, unquote, it merely lends to take away again, attend this lesson well. The world provides no safety. It is rooted in attack, and all its, quote, gifts, unquote, of seeming safety are illusory deceptions. It attacks and then attacks again. No peace of mind is possible where danger threatens thus. Right off the bat, tells it like it is.
It is amazing how Jesus is just so clear. And I mean, that is your experience. Is this your experience in the world?
Yeah.
That is my experience in the world. Yeah, it's an attack and attack and attack and attack, and then it's going to attack again. Uh-huh. And how could I possibly be at peace when all that's happening is being attacked? So
Interestingly, I think our egos interpret when we read this as, oh, this is, you know, he's being mean. But no, he's saying what's really mean is the mean-spirited thought system, which is ego, is really what attacks. And he says he's basically very gently and calmly stating the obvious when we really open our eyes metaphorically and really look at what the ego is about and see it in all of its hideous splendor, I guess you could say, and see how desolate that thought system is. Why would anyone want to be there? But we only get that in little glimpses usually. It's the start, and then we see more and more, and then pretty soon we notice that the, you know, the ego's director's cut track that, you know, travels along the ticker tape of our mind, that is the, you know, the illusory message, the illusory interpretation, really couldn't possibly offer us any peace, because it's the ego's thought system is only about attack and danger and revenge and being threatened, and it has nothing to do with reality. So yeah.
Right. Well, that's the only way it works.
Yeah.
It couldn't work if it didn't keep us in fear. And so, you know, that's, if you're in fear, voila, you know,
exactly.
you've fallen into the trap and,
yep,
and you are absolutely caught up. And so, you know, this idea that somehow or the other, I could be in safety, I could feel safe in this crazy world. It doesn't even make sense how that could be. I mean, it seems impossible, and it seems like there must be some kind of magical protection spell or something, you know, that Jesus is going to give us this magical protection spell, and it's going to somehow or the other keep bad things from happening to us. And that's, you know, I spend my whole life, you know, saying rosaries and you know, praying and, you know, going to church and, you know, doing, you know, not stepping on a crack so I don't break my mother's back and doing all the magical protection spells that I could come up with. And, you know, I still keep getting attacked over and over and over and over. You know, I take my medicine, you know, that's supposed to help me with my, you know, heart condition or whatever. You know, these are all magical protection spells that I've taken up in order to try to protect myself because I feel so attacked. I feel so vulnerable. And Jesus is telling us none of that is necessary because you're not in danger. And so, you know, let us look at why you think you need to defend yourself and why it's true that you don't have to. So he says the world, this is paragraph 2 of this lesson, the world gives rise but to defensiveness. For threat brings anger. Anger makes attack seem reasonable, honestly provoked, and righteous in the name of self-defense. Yet is defensiveness a double threat, for it attests to weakness and sets up a system of defense that cannot work. Now are the weak still further undermined, for there is treachery without and still a greater treachery within. The mind is now confused and knows not where to turn to find escape from its imaginings. And about spells, and for me, that's...
Yeah. The treachery without and within, I think, is an allusion to the double shield of oblivion, which was referenced in the was it 136 lesson? I believe it is. And, you know, that's basically the whole, you know, the whole system of defense that the ego has is, let's make up a whole world to keep us mindless. And there's the treachery without. And forever scrambling to try to defend a body against death and decay and attack from innumerable things from everything from quarks to quasars, you know, and certainly all the things that are about our own size and the space dimension and the time dimension, you know, all you have to do is if you want to scare somebody, just say, you know, what can you give me that will, you know, make me tremble with fear. Oh, how about it? How about a century? You know, most people don't want a century added to their age. that's a gift that most people will say, no, don't give me that. I want this time. You know, I that sort of thing, you know, cause we're so invested in the belief that, you know, we have a finite amount of time because we're invested in a body, you know, an emperor's clothing, scenario that is, you know, intrinsically doomed to fail, but we don't even think about that very often. We don't think about the idea that, well, okay, eventually I'm going to have to, you know, give up this cloak, this facade, you know, this costume and, you know, do something else. But anyway, but yeah, the treachery within and without, I think, is and the double shield of oblivion go really well together as metaphors for the way that the ego thinks it has it all sewn up, all wrapped up, and a foolproof system to keep us mindless, so that we don't look at the unconscious guilt that the world conceals, but. It's not God-proof because the voice we took with us into the dream that reminds us of our true Christ nature says, what guilt? It didn't happen.
Right.
And if you use the world, you turn the whole system inside out and use the world as a reminder for when I see my thoughts projected out in a way that I find discomfort or pain or any irritation, or any kind of condemnation, that's my clue. That's my instantaneous dashboard feedback to say, okay, look at the mind, see the thought system that's telling you that. Notice that is the ego's ticker tape scrolling along with its insane interpretations. Just notice that doesn't work for you anymore, and then say, okay, but there is a thought system in the mind that is basically that's just a reflection of. And we can choose against that thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, and know that beyond that, the special love and the special hate, there is a true love, a true peace, a true kindness that is eternal, and that is our way. We're home. That's our ticket out of the nightmare. So,
right, and it's a way that is. It's always available and it's always helpful. And yet, you know, we look at it and say, or I look at it and say, but But
we also have to get our butt in there, huh?
I got to get my butt in there and say, but this person is really bad, or this situation is really scary, or this thing is beyond the help that anything could give me. And the thing that's helped me so much in all of this, you know, I keep going back to this, but it's the truth, is that the script is written. And whatever is happening is beyond my control. I don't have a way to bring about world peace or change the minds of people who are in power with things, or, you know, that's not in my realm to be able to do that. The only thing that's in my realm to be able to do is to change my own mind about what I think I see, and change my own perception of the danger that it entails, this perception of danger that brings me to this desire to be in, to defend myself. And I think back to lesson 135, which I think is real interesting that this is 153 and that's 135, 135, 13, you know, whatever. Because if I defend myself, I'm attacked. Mm-hmm. Is the same thing.
Yep.
Is saying, if I think there's something here that can harm me, then I've already attacked myself by negating the truth of what I am, negating the reality of what I am. And I believe that somehow or the other, something has to change in my circumstance in order for me to be safe. And, you know, what Jesus is telling us in this lesson, in all lessons, is there is no change in your circumstance of your body or your world or anything that is going to make you safer. If I won the Powerball and I had millions of dollars and, you know, I had never had to worry about, you know, anything physically in this world again, I still would be being attacked by my body. I still would be being attacked by my brothers, my, you know, everything that appears outside of me can only be seen as an attack because it is outside of me and has the ability to harm me. You know, in my mind, it has the ability to harm me. And so, you know, I'm still believing, no matter what my earthly circumstance is, I'm still going to believe that it's not right, it's not good enough, and it isn't what I need. And it's true. It's a shabby substitute for heaven. So it can never help me, can never serve me, can never make me happy. So, you know, what is it that I'm defending is, you know, what I think is a little lifeline toward being happy. You know, and it's not true. I can't make up. I can't invent my own safety because I invented my own danger. So, you know, all I have to do is recognize, oh, I made that up. And, you know, what I think this person is doing, or what I think this situation has a capability of making happen, it can't be, because there's nothing outside of God and nothing can harm a son of God. And this lesson, you know, tells us about, you know, the whole idea of being the son of God and what, how important it is to recognize that in ourselves and our brothers. So I'll let you go ahead. You want to read paragraph 3 here?
Sure. It is as if a circle held it fast, wherein another circle bound it and another one in that, until escape can no longer be hoped for nor obtained. Attack, defense, defense, attack, become the circles of the hours and the days that bind the mind in heavy bands of steel with iron overlaid, returning but to start again. There seems to be no break nor ending in the ever-tightening grip of the imprisonment upon the mind. Kind of reminds me of the Sisyphus metaphor that Ken Wapnick uses in From Futility to Happiness, little book and audio that he did. And how, you know, it's just never-ending firefighting process that we are asked in this world to attend to. But the Course says, well, maybe you could chew gum and walk. Maybe you could do the things in the world that you need to do while being more mindful and just noticing whenever something pushes your buttons, that's the cue to ask Holy Spirit for help. That's the the little light on the dashboard, the Holy Spirit's dashboard that lights up that says, hey, I've got a thought system you might want to try again. That suggests that there is you could see peace instead of this, you know. Not that you deny the data from your senses, but you deny the ego's interpretation of that data. And you say, you know, okay, you know, I don't have to take this personally. You know, you use a little Don Miguel Ruiz, idea, you know, that if we think that we're a person, then we take things personally. But if we begin to adopt the idea of a transpersonal identity, that our real identity consists in the relationships that we have with not just certain people, but everyone, which you alluded to a moment ago, when you said, you know, if we start making exceptions and say, well, I see, you know, kindness or you know, goodness in this person, but not in this other one. You know, if we leave any family member or politician or celebrity or whoever, you know, if any person, place, or thing that crosses our mind is worthy of condemnation to us, then we can pretty much say that we've made the same assessment of ourselves, because those are all projections. And if you know, like Dove's phrase, if you spot it, you got it. And if we see something that's worthy of condemnation, then that means we're making that assessment of ourselves. We're saying that sin, guilt, and fear is real, and we need to be condemned. We need to punish. And that's the ego's, you know, arrogant prerogative it takes is say, well, okay, I'll beat God to the punch because I've dethroned him anyway. I'll just, you know, punish myself. And then we sabotage our lives in countless ways to make ourselves miserable, to reinforce the idea that, see, this course doesn't work. There's no God. It's all a sham, and so forth. But the beauty of it is that once we start seeing that it's our interpretations that get us in trouble, and stop believing those quite so much and less over time, we have a greater peace that is not contingent on what happens or doesn't happen in the world. And then, like Krishnamurti, you know, was asked, you know, what's your secret? He says, well, I don't care what happens. And he didn't mean that he was uncaring. He just meant that he was invested in the outcomes of the specific circumstances that those had no impact on his true being, his true identity, the true identity that we all share. That's the shared identity that the Course asks us to look at. And that's why there's so much emphasis on relationships, because if we realize that it's how we see each other and you know, let each other off the hook as we let ourselves off the hook for a crime of duality that we never committed, that's pretty nice. that gets to be something we look forward to more and more and more. And there's a self-reinforcing, you know, principle there that, you know, the more we find peace, the more we're drawn to the more profound ocean as we, you know, taste a few drips of the ocean of peace. You know, it's like, well, you know, maybe I could have more of this. I could see peace instead of this ego interpretation that I'm dabbling in, you know. Yeah.
And the knowing that the outcome is certain.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And this lesson tells us that. This lesson talks about that, you know, it doesn't matter what you think is going to happen. The outcome is certain, and you will always win. Yep. And that being known, then what are you fighting for? If you knew that you never had to move a muscle, do anything in order to win the war, and all you had to do was just be still and listen to the voice for the Holy Spirit, listen to the voice for God, and all things would come to you. All, you know, every weapon you would ever need, every tool that you would ever want, anything that would seem necessary in order for the war to be won is given to you freely, as is given to all of us freely. Then if you knew that that was the case, and that there was no possibility of failure, then you could relax and quit fighting. Mm-hmm. You could relax and say, okay, you're right. You know, whatever your brother seems to be terribly wrong, just, you know, just recognize, oh, you're right. You know, you are right because you're a son of God. And you are, and again, the thing that always comes to me is they are acting out a script just as I am acting out a script. It doesn't make them the character.
Right.
And Jesus talks about that in this lesson, too. So I'm going to read the next paragraph. Paragraph 4, are we there? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Defenses are the costliest of all the prices which the ego would exact. In them lies madness in a form so grim that hope of sanity seems to be but an idle dream beyond the possibility, beyond the possible. The sense of threat the world encourages is so much deeper and so far beyond the frenzy and intensity of which you can conceive that you have no idea of all the devastation it has wrought. And I'm going to just go into the next paragraph. You are its slave. You know not what you do in fear of it. You do not understand how much you have been made to sacrifice, who feel its iron grip upon your heart. You do not realize that you have what you have done to sabotage the holy peace of God by your defensiveness. For you behold the Son of God as but a victim to attack by fantasies, by dreams, and by illusions he has made, yet helpless in their presence, needful only of defense by still more fantasies and dreams by which the illusions of his safety comfort him. And I mean, that's it. When I am caught up in all this costly defense that I'm going on and on about, it's just so insane, so threatening, so terrifying that I am in its grips. I am its slave. I don't know what to do. I can't protect myself, and I just have to do it in whatever way I can. And for the most part, it's by attacking you, by attacking the world, attacking my body, attacking the things that make me afraid. That's the only way I know how to save myself is by attacking. But that means that I'm caught up in the circles within circles within circles, yeah, of just madness, just going around and around and around and around. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of that song, oh, sinner man, where are you going to run to? Where are you going to run to on that day? Run to the rock, run to the mountain, run. Everywhere you run, there is nothing going to save you. Of course, the song is about, you know, when Jesus comes back and throws everybody who's bad into hell. But the reality of it is, I'm already in that. I'm already in that. And I'm the one who's running to all these different places trying to find safety. And the only place there is safety is in my relationship with myself, my brother, my God. It's one relationship. And that one relationship tells me that none of them mean me any harm. None of them can harm me.
Yeah, talk about a contrast in thought systems, you know, in the song you're describing and the, you know, the formal religious belief that, you know, Jesus is going to be the one that condemns us to hell. You know, what a sharp contrast to A Course in Miracles message that, you know, the Jesus of A Course in Miracles is suggesting, no, you put yourself in hell. But better yet, this is not a real hell. This is a dream of a hellacious, dualistic existence that you can wake up from. And better yet, I'm going to give you a really simple process that I'm going to call true forgiveness that will give you the e-ticket, supersonic transport ride home to the peace that you never left and to the heaven that you thought you abandoned. And you're already there waiting to wake up from the dream. But you know, since you think you're here, I'll meet you where you think you're at and give you the tools you think you need in the language that you think, you know, is going to be helpful to you. because, you know, why would I not give you what is going to be helpful? It's only the ego that basically tries to obfuscate and to deny and to distract and divert and all that kind of stuff. A moment ago when you were talking about defensiveness, I was thinking, you know, in this country, I saw a pie chart once that showed the budget of the United States, and I think about half of it was direct or indirect military spending, and I was thinking, wow, that's amazing. And yet, which I think wasn't the speech of the guy that was on the newsroom show, the newscaster, whose actor's name, oh, Jeff Daniels, made this speech on the newsroom show, if you ever caught that, about how, you know, America's first and all these things, you know, and one of the things he spouted off was, you know, yeah, we lead the world in spending a nuclear and military, you know, we have more than, what is the next, I don't know, some dozen or, you know, teen number of other countries combined. We spend more on that. Well, that pales in comparison to the ego. The ego's entire budget is nothing but defense. I mean, that is all it knows what to do. It only knows how to defend a dream that it made up. And so that, if you think in terms of, you know, comparisons, that's the ultimate defensive system. And, it makes our country look wimpy by comparison in terms of defense investment. Anyway, shall I go on?
Sure, yeah. But talk about defense spending. Right now, I think our American president is demanding that other people spend more money defending themselves as well. And it just cracks me up that that's all we can think about is how can we defend ourselves? How much does it cost? That's all you have to do. What's the cost of our defense?
Well, I think the clue that you just revealed there is, how do we defend ourself? Well, what self? Is it the capitalist self that needs no defense, or is it the littlest self that is completely defenseless and seems to need it? You know, and there's nothing in the world that suggests that we shouldn't brush our teeth or go to the doctor or lock our doors or, you know, in appropriate situations or, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's just, it's not suggesting that we don't do the normal appropriate things on the level of form. It's basically just saying, look at the thoughts in the mind that are based on fear and just watch that insanity play out. And, you know, we can distance ourselves not from the behavior, but just from the investment in thinking that this is my identity. It's the identity investment, I think, that really is at the core of what the Course is suggesting that we just look at. We don't have to do anything differently necessarily, although our behavior may change over time as we, you know, kind of realize how ridiculous some of this stuff is. And generally, the idea is just like, look at the contents of your mind and see what brings you peace, see what doesn't, and just be very objective and actually kind of scientific about it. Just see that the ego's defensive insanity and its panic mode, which it tries to mask with just sort of, oh, I'm just, you know, being busy and productive to take care of things I need to take care of. And yeah, sometimes we are. And other times, if we just look at the contents of our minds and say, yeah, but there's a fear behind it, you know, just kind of notice those fear thoughts and see how much we're really motivated by defensiveness and then forgive ourselves and just say, oh, that's silly. You know, I could still be doing what I'm doing, but just not be panicky about it. Right.
So. Exactly. There's no, when you have this thought system in place in your mind, then fear is impossible. Mm-hmm. Fear comes up and you can just tell it where to go. And for me to ask the question, where did that thought come from? Who told me that was something I need to be afraid of? And why would I believe that thing? And, bring yourself back to the reality of who you are. It's not bypassing or, you know, jumping or anything like that. It's focusing on the reality. I think I'm, you know, starving and, there's no food and I don't go and look in the cupboard to see if there's anything there, then I'm just going to sit, you know, in the dining room saying, you know, I'm going to starve to death. But, you know, my cupboards are full of food. So you know, all I have to do is get up and open one up and see. And that's really what I think is the situation here. We think we're starving. We think we've been somehow something has been kept from us, that we haven't received everything that other people have received. I haven't been given everything that everyone else has, and I'm looking at it through the eyes of the world and my body, and, you know, thinking I deserve all this goodness too. Why am I not having it? And, you know, that the whole reason is because I haven't got up and looked in the cupboard. I've just been sitting here wailing and bemoaning my situation and being jealous of other people in their situation. And also, you know, some people seem to be in a worse situation. You know, I don't feel better because I see you're in a bad situation. I feel guilt. And
that's really the only option that the ego has is guilt, you know, and some variation of it. I mean, fear, dread, jealousy, you know, all those things are just basically permutations of that core, you know, fearful thought of retaliation for a crime that we never committed.
Yeah, right, and that somebody has something I don't.
Yeah.
The idea that God gave you something he didn't give me. God made you a man. You know, and look at all the advantages that men have in this world. You know, I am really pissed about that, Bruce. And
well, if you were a person and I were a person, I'd have to agree.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that brings up another. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, that brings up another thing that I think is one more where the rubber meets the road. Most of us, you know, nowadays don't have too many day-to-day confrontations with saber-toothed tigers or there's some people that have to deal with lava flow and things, you know, what insurance company calls acts of God, and nuclear threats and things like that, which are kind of more vague, general, diffuse, you know, fear kind of things. But the everyday stuff that most of the time we deal with, you know, is our human interactions. And if somebody, you know, calls you on the carpet or says something that disturbs you, it's interesting to just watch when we defend ourselves and, you know, instead of saying, you know, with a knee jerk, oh, this person's a jerk for saying this, you know, we could say, well, what if this is a call for love? What if it's really my call for love? And what if I actually listen to what's being said, recognize the validity on the level, you know, a form as well as the metaphoric level, and say, wow, this person, a Christ, a savior in my mind, has given me a gift to look at what's my own projection, and I can see that anything that bothers me on an everyday basis, whether it's a grocery clerk or another driver on the road or a coworker or a family member or, you know, a neighbor, whatever. I mean, just the everyday stuff. If we can just kind of notice all the things that where either we find ourselves doing or saying something that we, you know, don't feel completely comfortable with, or something appears to arrive in our minds in basket to either have a, you know, reaction or response to, just to say, oh, well, am I defending myself? What do I need to defend? And just notice when it's the ego speaking and, you know, covering up or making excuses or justifying certain things, or, you know, just being defensive, and then ask yourself, what do I really need to defend here? And can I just honestly say, well, gee, you know, I think, you know, even on the level of form, sometimes it's very appropriate to say, gee, you know, I had never thought of it that way. I'll take a look at that, and I'll look at my, you know, my actions or my words or my behavior or whatever, and I'll consider that. You know, maybe I was being inconsiderate. Maybe I wasn't, you know, applying you know, the awareness that I could. And so, you know, on a very pragmatic way, sometimes those seemingly external calls for love can be, very helpful and give us a way to get back to, a shared interest that we maybe otherwise would have, left on the battleground, instead of elevated that relationship with whatever person we're dealing with to one of kindness and appreciation.
So that was beautifully said. I love that. And so for me, when I think these kind of things, I have to remember, and I do remember this. I asked for this. Mm-hmm. I asked Sean this. And you know, if you're coming at me and, you know, acting aggressive or saying things like, you know, Lynn, you're really not a very good teacher or, you know, whatever thoughts, you know, are coming, those are thoughts I'm thinking myself. I asked for that feedback and reflection, and now I have a choice of what to do with it. And, you know, either I can attack you for giving me what I asked for, or I can say, oh, look, I guess I did ask for this. I guess this was something that I wanted to see. And, you know, what is the last unanswered question? Am I willing to see what I denied because it was the truth? You know, that's really, it's a willingness to see that this is here for me. There's nothing happening. This conversation with you and me, it's not happening for anybody who's listening or anybody else. It really is happening for me. And, you know, if it's a call for love, it is a call for love. You know, and it is, that's all it could be, either love or a call for love, and both are the same thing. And so, you know, I just have to ask myself again, you know, where'd that thought come from? And, you know, is this remembering that this is for me, it's for my own best interest, not for anything else.
Yep. I would just say, the good news, Lynn, is that you are a great teacher. The bad news is that you're not Lynn.
Exactly.
And that's only bad news for the ego, right?
That is the good news. And
it really is.
Yeah. Talks to us about this in this lesson. So you want to go ahead and read, why don't you read the next couple paragraphs?
Sure. Okay, 6 and 7. Defenselessness is strength. It testifies to recognition of the Christ in you. Perhaps you will recall the text maintains that choice is always made between Christ's strength and your own weakness, seen apart from him. Defenselessness can never be attacked, because it recognizes strength so great, attack is folly, or a silly game a tired child might play when he becomes too sleepy to remember what he wants. Defensiveness is weakness. It proclaims you have denied the Christ and come to fear his Father's anger. What can save you now from your delusion of an angry God, whose fearful image you believe you see at work in all the evils of the world? What but illusions could defend you now, when it is but illusions that you fight? And this reminds me of last night, via Netflix, my wife and I watched a movie that was very well done, kind of a realistic, in a sense, drama called The Florida Project. Have you seen that one, Lynn, by any chance?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard of it at all.
Okay. Anyway, it's basically set in a Florida motel that's essentially a kind of a slummy area outside of Disney World in Florida, and it follows two main characters that are interacting is this motel manager and this young lady who's got a young daughter and they basically are just getting by, and it's sort of a child raising a child kind of a story, and so you get to see the folly and the fun they try to have in the world, and I was just thinking what a great metaphor as you know, anything seen properly is, for the, you know, the, like lesson 182 says, you know, all the dreams that we try to, you know, the homes we try to make in this world that never satisfy us. And you get to see the movie opens with these kids playing and, you know, the shenanigans they do and then the trouble they get into but it's, you know, it's just a reflection of the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, you know, propagating across generations, but that's really taking place in our mind. And anyway, so I noticed, you know, there are moments of compassion and caring, and then there was a whole lot of just acting out I'm not necessarily recommending the film, but I thought what a great reminder that all the things that we think are going to comfort us, whether it's shopping or thinking that we do certain things for fun, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, the whole gamut of stuff that we think is going to make us happy. There's nothing wrong with the world. It's just that it doesn't exist, and we've used it to be a weapon against ourselves. And I think that's what the Course is suggesting, you know, is that, you know, defensiveness is weakness and defenselessness is strength. That, you know, it becomes a pretty obvious choice. So, and that's where we're always presented, the opportunity to look at our mind and that choice point in our mind.
Oh,
you want the next couple?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and I'm looking up that Florida project. You know what? It got 96% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It was very, very well done. I mean, it looked like somebody just basically had put a hidden camera in. Yeah, I mean, it was that kind of realism. You know, the acting was really superb. It wasn't a particularly inspiring story, but it was just kind of like a look at, and a very compassionate one in some way of, you know, the things that, the situations that people have dreamt up to get themselves into, in this world. And I think we can all relate to, kind of the sense of hopelessness and the drudgery and the, you know, what do I got to do to make a living and the, you know, that, all that stuff. But it's just one more example of how elaborate the lengths we've gone to make a fantasy world, and then without giving too much of it away, that, you know, it's the fact that it's the backdrop is a Disney theme park, just, you know, a few blocks away. It kind of alludes to the fact that, you know, we're all in this fantasy world. We're all in, and I was thinking about, I haven't been to Disney World, but I've been to Disneyland in Southern California two or three times in my younger years, and you know, the frontier land, you know, that we think that there's still a frontier left to conquer or to explore, in the adventure land, you know, and the tomorrow land. It's always something a little bit outside of us, that is going to make us happy. And then there's the main street, you know, that is the core of, you know, giving to get, and I was reflecting on when I remember going on Main Street that as a kid the coolest thing was these little hand grips that you put a dime in, and it ran a little electric current, and you had to see how far you could go until the current got more and more until you finally had to let go, kind of thing. I'm sure they've outlawed those by now, but when I was a kid they still had those on the Main Street at Disneyland, and along with the Hall of Presidents, where these animatronic presidents would stand up and give inspiring speeches, and kind of almost brings a nostalgic quality back to my mind. Anyway,
oh my gosh, yeah.
But it's all fantasy land. It's all just a dream that we made up to think that there's something in the world that's going to do it for us, and that we need to defend this world. We need to defend our bodies in the world, and then we defend the thought system that made up the world. And it's like, wait a minute. He's telling us this lesson. This is all, you know, a holographic production that's putting Disney to shame. Not that any other, you know, CGI studio is exempt from that, but you know, we've put so much effort into making this believable and realistic, like that movie seemed to be last night, you know, and believable characters and stories. It's like, well, you know, we forget that it's a movie. This is just a big holographic movie, and we are the prime character in our particular version of that holographic movie. So.
Exactly. And none of the characters, even though it appears when you're watching the movie that these characters seem to be in stress or fear or joy or love or any of these things, it's a movie. And when it ends, it says, you know, the end. I don't know if they say that on movies anymore. They don't really. But, but you know, running the credits, they're running the credits, and you're like, oh, you know what? You know, I can go outside in the sun or, you know, in the night or whatever. And, you know, this story is over. This story is over, except I drag it around with me in my mind and I think about it. And I, you know, there's a lot of times, you know, I still have fear for, you know, things that happen in movies or things that
I saw. Oh, sure.
I have, my mother used to call it, everybody called it, the nuns at school, everybody called it, you have an overactive imagination. And and I think about it now, boy, darn tootin' I do.
And so does every other being on this planet and this universe, you know. I think that's one of the things that is actually very helpful, that of course, from miracles, you know, like Jesus says early on in the text, he says, you know, if I were to give away, you know, your ability to choose, I would be violating the law of cause and effect, the most fundamental law there is, and denigrating the power of your mind. He's saying, your mind is extremely powerful. My mind is extremely powerful. Together, we made up a whole universe and peopled it with all kinds of strange and exotic creatures that live at the bottom of the ocean and float in the upper atmosphere and you know, from microbes to you know, on and galaxies we haven't even fathomed. And, you know, this whole thing is just an incredibly elaborate hoax. I mean, talk about MGM Worlds and Warner Brothers Lifetimes, as Richard Bach said in his Illusions book, you know, it's all just smoke and mirrors. But until we start seeing that and recognizing that the movie is not going to make us happy, it's the reality, the waking up from the dream, leaving the theater and just saying, ah, I don't have to project a fearful world anymore. I can see peace instead of the dream, and I can still appear to be in the dream, but not be invested in that identity anymore.
Exactly. And Carrie says it's a con. It is. It's a con.
It's a huge con game. Yeah. It's the biggest con game there is. And it's because of our overactive imaginations that we pulled it off with better than any CGI studio could do when the names scroll pad, the credits scroll past and you see these places and countries all over the world, you with dozens and dozens of, or hundreds and hundreds on some of these movies, of people working to make the special effects to make it seem believable. Well, I mean, hey, think of what a team we've assembled to project a whole universe that seems believable. And it's so watertight that it makes the Truman Show's, you know, precautions to not have Truman find out that he's on a giant soundstage seem wimpy at best, you know. I mean, the light that falls from the sky and crashes, and that was his first clue, you know. It's like, hey, maybe I'm on a giant soundstage here. Well, the clue that we're in a similar, you know, soundstage, and a set, a movie set, is that we have these feelings that say, there must be a better way. There's got to be something that works better than this. I mean, you know, 3 score and 10 and we're out of here, that kind of, you know, give or take a few decades, you know. There's got to be something better than just and you're gone kind of so-called reality, you know.
It reminds me, you know, I always bring up this show Westworld that I'm watching, avidly and enjoying tremendously. And that's the whole story of Westworld. It's a con. Mm-hmm. And every bit of it is a con. And every bit of the con is just another story that is there to make the world seem more real and make the con appear to be the truth. You know, that's all that's happening. And I'm going to send you, I'm going to post a link in here for you, to watch this. This is amazing. This video is amazing. And this guy who made this video is, brilliant. And, you might enjoy watching others of his stuff once you see this.
Okay.
But it is all about, and I posted it in the room too, so
okay,
people
thanks.
Go there and look. And it's about Westworld, and I think you'll find it really fascinating.
Okay. I've loved it. I'll watch afterwards, yeah.
Okay. So Travels in Hyperreality is what
okay.
it's called.
Okay.
So, it's like, this is exactly what's happening here. So, I will go to the, are we on paragraph 7?
I believe 7, yeah. Huh?
Okay. So, defensiveness is weakness. It proclaims you have denied the Christ and come to fear his Father's anger. What can save you now from your delusion of an angry God whose fearful image you believe you see at work in all the evils of the world? What but illusions could defend you now when it is but illusions that you fight? We will not play such childish games today. For our true purpose is to save the world, you idiots. Don't you know what you're here for? Quit playing games.
I think Jesus is calling us idiots, but in the nicest, kindest possible way. He's saying, you're just little kids playing silly games. You know, you can get out of the sandbox anytime you want.
It's so funny. But our true purpose is to save the world, and we would not exchange for foolishness the endless joy our function offers us. We would not let our happiness slip by because of a fragment of a senseless dream happened to cross our minds, and we mistook the figures in it for the Son of God, its tiny instant for eternity. Wow. Yeah, exactly, Jesus. What am I doing? What am I doing? Why am I doing that? Ugh, crazy.
Lynn, I just happened to flash, I don't know, the childish games line you just read. I was picturing kids playing in a sandbox, and then I was thinking, well, Jesus probably sees us as we really are, which is these eternally peaceful adults dressed up as kids with little baby bonnets and bibs and you know, rattles and stuff and baby booties, you know, in the sandbox. And you know, the image is just particularly humorous when you think of like how invested we are, and then, you know, throwing sand at each other's faces and, you know, all that puerile juvenile stuff that we do, that we think, well, that's, you know, that's adult discourse here, you know. Well, no, that's just, you know, little kids in big bodies, you know, playing war and you know, make, you know, or, you know, monkeys throwing their poop at each other, you know. It's there's not much maturity going on here.
No. You know?
And that's why Ken points out, you know, Ken Wapnick points out, is not once in the course does Jesus say that we're anything more than infants or children, you know. I'm sure that that's the perspective that our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, has of us, is that we are, you know, the mature spirit that we truly are, you know, a child, a man, and then a spirit, as one of Hill's poems says, you know, that we really are this infinitely mature and all-encompassing spirit. But we're dressed up as these little babes, that are just playing these mean-spirited, silly and senseless games in a dream, in a movie, in a sandbox. You know, mix your metaphors or whatever, but you know, it's just not real. Yeah.
No, and so why do we do it? Well, because I think we like it. You know, that's the thing. I think it's satisfying to make myself right and you wrong. It's satisfying for me to you know, I do it all the time, and it seems so subtle. In fact, you would think I didn't do it at all if you were listening to me, but I can see it in other people, in their face, if I say something that is really violent, but it doesn't appear to be violent to me. And so, you know, saying to somebody, you know, well, why don't you just forgive this and let it go? That's one of the meanest things you can say to anybody. Honestly, it sounds like, oh, this is a perfectly wonderful thing to say. No, it's bullshit. That is a thing you would say to somebody that you really want to sting. Because don't they already know that?
Well, again, that gets into the whole topic of forgiveness to destroy, which we could spend another hour and a half on real easily. And I've been attending Lynn Corona and Tim Wise's classes, study groups on Tuesday and Thursday mornings, and we've gone into that quite a bit, and it's talked about in the pamphlets, the supplements, and to A Course in Miracles that quite extensively. And so, but yeah, we should spend some time talking about forgiveness to destroy in another conversation, huh?
Well, yeah, because it really is what happens, and it is my daily experience in the world and my daily experience with my brother. And, you know, if I don't learn how to cut it out, if I just continue to want to make me right and make you wrong, then I'm going to be miserable. I'm miserable already about it. There's nothing about that can make you happy. And you always feel, this is one of those things where I always know the guilt. I always feel guilty when I do it. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I still feel righteous because I'm doing the right thing. But, you know, I'm guilty because I'm attacking my brother. So this is a circular thing that goes on and on and on. And until you jump out of it and go into, like, instead of the horizontal thinking, go into the vertical thinking where you just recognize, oh, you know, we're all right. You know, that's what Jesus tells us. Tell your brother that he's right.
Above the battleground of duality, how could there be an adversary in perfect oneness? There's nothing to get hung about, as the Beatles say. You know? There's nothing to be a problem, and then nothing to forgive. And I think that's where, you know, when we try to forgive on the battlefield as a warrior, you know, we're still seeing an adversary there who has wronged us, and vengeance, you know, we want blood and guts in our teeth, you know, what, maybe metaphorically, if not physically, but that's the ego's game, is revenge for a crime that never happened. And it's only because we've projected out, the things that in our own mind that we don't like, that we have adversaries, whether they take the form of people or events or bodily situations or financial situations or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't matter. All those things are just adversaries that we've made up to keep us mindless. But above the battleground, we can, you know, of duality, we can look with our inner kindness teacher at those things, and moment to moment, as the issues come up, we can say, oh, I'm choosing to invest my identity in something less than peace here if I make a big deal out of this. It doesn't mean our behavior necessarily changes. We might still be saying the same things and doing the same things in many cases. But if we let ourselves and each other off the hook by recognizing that nothing in reality, nothing in eternal truth happened to anyone or anything, that's really the only basis, the only true jurisdiction where the case is dismissed. That's the only place where true forgiveness works, and everything else is forgiveness to destroy. It's basically saying this infraction, this crime against truth happened, and so now, out of the goodness of my holier-than-thou heart, I forgive you for what you did. You know, you can't make a crime real and then forget, you know, of course it says, you know, that's unmerited. Why would you want to forgive something that really happened? But it's only if it never happened. And that's why, you know, I think rereading the What is Forgiveness on page 401 of the workbook is helpful. And I a tip of the hat to Beverly in Phoenix, Oregon, her study group there, still meeting on Tuesday nights, as she cruises into her mid-90s, I think, and suggests appropriately so that every study group begin with the rereading of that What is Forgiveness, because it's so potent. It's such a great reminder that you know, we have to not look, we have to look at what the ego says is real, and then say, you know, that's not real. We have to deny the denial of truth in order to truly forgive, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And this next couple of paragraphs, I mean, the rest of this lesson really talks about how we do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to read paragraph 9?
Oh, sure.
Maybe
sure.
Also?
Okay, sure. 9. We look past dreams today and recognize that we need no defense because we are created unassailable without all thought or wish or dream in which attack has any meaning. Now we cannot fear, for we have left all fearful thoughts behind. And in defenselessness, we stand secure, serenely certain of our safety now, sure of salvation, sure we will fulfill our chosen purpose as our ministry extends its holy blessing through the world. Be still a moment, and in silence think how holy is your purpose, how secure you rest, untouchable within its light. God's ministers have chosen that the truth be with them. Who is holier than they? Who could be sure that his happiness is fully guaranteed? And who could be more mightily protected? What defense could possibly be needed by the ones who are among the chosen ones of God, by his election and their own as well? And before we go on, I just want to say that paragraph might be one of the most easily misunderstood in the course if you use level confusion and think it's talking about some people being teachers and some people not, or thinking that it applies only to people who are studying the course or whatever. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. This is really about saying the thoughts in our mind that are holy, if you will, are those that include everyone in all of spirit. We see that every person, everything is truly that. And it's basically saying that thought system is where the holiness resides. And everyone has that. Everyone is that in truth. So to make it a we-they thing would be totally contrary to the intent of the course. And just because of the way this is written, I could see where this could easily be misconstrued. And I just want to point that out.
Thank you for that. And you're right about that. That there is no us and them. There's
exactly.
We and they. It is all one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting to me how Jesus' tone here, you know, he starts out and he's talking about, you know, this is how children act. This is what children do. This mm-hmm. is how children, in, you know, infants with their toys, you know, this is what they do. But he's saying, this is not what you are.
Right.
Look past that dream, that thought that you are those things. You are a minister of God. I am among the ministers of God. And I'm not a child playing with my toys in a sandbox and attempting at war. If I just remember myself and just remember myself and just bring myself back to it, then I can work from this position and not be attacking and defending, because I'm beyond that in being who I am. And it sounds like you have some thought there.
You know, again, the sandbox metaphor jumped into my mind. Another funny image. I was thinking, well, you know, we think that we're these fierce warriors and our shields and our swords. But Jesus, really, I think, you know, and the perspective of the Course, the inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit of the Course, that voice with us we took within the dream, that perspective, I think, probably sees us more truly as this infinitely wonderful spirit that we all share, disguised as these little babies. And what we think of as a sword is really like a little rattle, and the shield is a bib, and it's just this silly thing that we're playing, and we make believe that these things that we've projected out are these fearful, terrible things, and we've made up an identity that we savagely protect to the death, and it's just such a silly game, you know. It's a big Truman Show that we all made up, and you know, we're acting in, and we think it's all about us, but we don't notice the cameras and the choreography and the scripting that's taking place to make it seem real to whatever thought system we've chosen. There's only two. And if we use ego's thought system, then it's going to be this fearful, scary thing. But there's another thought system that takes every single thing and dismantles ego's interpretation of it and provides Holy Spirit's translation, which is, I can see peace instead of this. Yeah. So anyway, exactly. Do you want to read the next couple?
You just remind me of, do you ever watch this TV? It's a Cartoon Network show, and it's probably not even on the air anymore, but I'm trying to think of what it's called. But it's about babies, and there are these little babies, and they talk to each other, and they do all different kinds of things, and they are like, they don't know what anything is, but they are making up stories in their own minds about things that happen and trying to explain it to each other about why this happened or what's going on. Mm-hmm. And they're doing all their infantile things, and it's so cute. Rugrats. The show is called Rugrats.
I guess I haven't seen that one.
Oh, yeah, it's so adorable when you watch it because this is a perfect thing. You know, the babies, they have their world and their idea about what's happening and their thoughts about, you know, why mom took the dog to, you know, someplace and he came back with a cone on his head and, you know, what does that mean to us? And, you know, they have all these ideas.
They're from France.
They're coneheads from France, exactly. But at the same time, they have the adult world. And the adults who, you know, are supposed to be, you know, so rational are equally ignorant of what is happening. You know, they see things from a different direction, but they're completely confused as well. Uh-huh. And so interpreting things, they interpret what the babies are doing and they think what the babies are saying. And, you know, oh, look, he's trying to tell us something. You know, they're misinterpreting as well. So even the adults in that are not adults.
We're all Mr. Magoo's here, right?
Exactly. And it really shows you how clueless those who think they know are, and how wise those who are just trying to figure it out and have no explanation are. It's the same thing. The babies and the parents are the same. And that's when you look at this world and you look at all these people that seem so confused and so unaware and so incapable of making good decisions or whatever it is that we're looking at other people and thinking about them. We don't know. You don't know. You are just as confused as they are. You have no basis, and I think our reading from yesterday or the day before really went into that and talked about how, you know, you think you are making decisions based on something that you are completely clueless about, have no idea, and somehow or the other you think that, you know, you have a handle on reality that really you don't have at all.
Our cues for inference are wrong, as chapter 21 starts out saying, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Everything that we perceive is inaccurate. And so we're perceiving our brothers as being something that is less than or has no, you know, they are defense, or they're not able to know things. And so I'm in charge. I have to fix things. But what paragraph 11, I'm going to go ahead and read.
Okay.
It is the function of God's ministers to help their brothers choose as they have done. God has elected all, but few have come to realize his will is but their own. And while you fail to teach what you have learned, salvation waits and darkness holds the world in grim imprisonment. Nor will you learn that light has come to you and your escape has been accomplished. For you will not see the light until you offer it to all your brothers. As they take it from your hands, so will you recognize it as your own. And to me, Jesus very clearly is saying that until I give my brother the knowing in my mind that they are the Son of God,
mm-hmm.
and that they can be right, nothing, they can do nothing wrong, they are not wrong, they can't be wrong, until I give that to them and give them the light and recognize the light in them, I'll never be able to see the light in myself. And so it's by offering them the light. And how do I offer my brother the light? I offer my brother the light by not judging him, criticizing him, wishing he were different, trying to change him. You know, that's all judgment, really. I mean, basically that's it. Judgment and then failing to forgive the notion that they can be something outside of God or something different. So, you know, once I start really looking at that and saying, you know, my brother's right, you are the Holy Son of God, nothing can change what God made you. You know, I say these things to myself about my brothers all the time because personally I don't believe it and I don't want to hear it. But if and you know, ego says, Jesus, you are mistaken about this. But I've chosen to be among the ministers of God. I've chosen God has offered it to me, which He has offered it to everyone. I want to accept it, and the only way that I can accept salvation is to recognize the light in my brother.
Yep.
And the only way I can see the light in myself is to recognize the light in my brother. That's why Jesus says in the manual for clarification of terms, Jesus is the name of a man who saw the face of Christ in everyone he saw, and so he remembered God. He saw the Christ in himself, and he remembered God.
Mm-hmm. That's or as Gary says in his Fearless Love audio, if we see all of Spirit, not part of it, but all of Spirit in everyone we meet, that's, you know, just basically the same thing, right?
Yes. But even seeing any part of Spirit in my brother, which means that, you know, I need to look. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't just take a glance and say, oh, no, he's bad, or they're doing the wrong thing, or whatever, or you're mistaken, you don't understand, you don't get A Course in Miracles. You know, none of that stuff. That's none of my business. My business is to look and say, you are right. You know, that you are right. You have the light, just like I have the light. We are all the same light. So let me look for that light in you instead of looking for the darkness. Let me look for that thing in you, that spark of holiness. The divine is what you are. Let me look for that instead of looking for your failure. And then once I'm willing to see it in you, then I am actually willing to see it in myself. Until I'm willing to see it in you, because I know it's there, and I'm purposely turning you away, I'm purposely saying, no, you're not good enough in my mind, no, you are wrong in my mind, but I know the truth is that you are the Holy Son of God and the same as me, then I'm going to feel guilty about that. I'm going to feel guilty for condemning you. I'm going to feel guilty for turning you away and not seeing you as my brother. And then I'm going to blame it on you. I'm feeling bad, but it's your fault because you're not exhibiting the kind of thing I expect the Son of God to be exhibiting. You know, I turn it over onto you. So it is just an endless cycle. Until I stop and actually choose to see the Christ. And then that changes everything. That shifts everything. Because there's no turning back from that, let me tell you. That this is experience. There's no turning back from that. You can pretend that your brother is something else, but you're never going to be able to see it, and you're always going to recognize, oh, I'm doing that again, and I feel guilty about it, and there's no reason for that. So, anyway, you want to go on and read the next paragraph?
Sure. Number 12, I think, is where we're at?
Yeah.
Okay. Salvation can be thought of as a game that happy children play. It was designed by one who loves his children, and who would replace their fearful toys with joyous games, which teach them that the game of fear is gone. His game instructs in happiness because there is no loser. Everyone who plays must win, and in his winning is the gain to everyone insured. The game of fear is gladly laid aside when children come to see the benefits salvation brings. Should I read the next one too?
Yeah, well, okay. I think we're all the winners.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it really gets back to that. We have to go beyond the we-they paradigm. As long as there's a loser, then we're all losers, you know, and that's just, you know, we all go home together or not at all, right? And the fact that we're already home makes that a little easier.
Yes.
That's a hint. Perfect. That's a hint and a help, right? Okay. You have played that you are lost to hope, abandoned by your father, left alone in terror in a fearful world, made mad by sin and guilt. Be happy now. That game is over. Now a quiet time has come in which we put away the toys of guilt and lock our quaint and childish thoughts of sin forever from the pure and holy minds of heaven's children and the Son of God.
Wow, what a relief.
Yeah. And I don't think he's saying, you know, to deny when we see the horrors of the world, but just to deny the ego's interpretation that could touch the reality beyond the illusion.
Yes, and also to deny the sovereignty of my brother, who is quite capable of living the life that he came here to live.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. You know, when I say, oh, my poor brother, he's so weak and I need to help him, you know.
Do you want to read the last paragraph?
Same thing. Yeah, let's read the last paragraph, because all this is, the rest of this is all about how we do it. In the last paragraph, let's see. Actually, let's read the last two. I think we have time. Today, our theme is our defenselessness. We clothe ourselves in it as we prepare to meet the day. We rise up strong in Christ and let our weakness disappear as we remember that His strength abides in us. We will remind ourselves that He remains beside us throughout the day, and He never leaves our weakness unsupported by His strength. We call upon His strength each time we feel the threat of our defenses undermine our certainty of purpose. We will pause a moment as He tells us, I am here. Your practicing will now begin to take the earnestness of love to help you keep your mind from wandering from its intent. Be not afraid or timid. There can be no doubt that you will reach your final goal. The ministers of God can never fail because the love and strength and peace that shine from them to all their brothers come from Him. These are His gifts to you. Defenselessness is all you need to give Him in return. You lay aside but what was never real to look on Christ and see His sinlessness.
I don't need any defenses for a self that's eternally safe and holy and innocent, and neither does anyone else, huh?
That's right. Neither does anyone else. Yeah. And there's no reason to reject them or be afraid of them or run from them or hate them. There's no reason to do anything but to love your brother and trust him. Trust my brothers who are one with me.
Yep. Thank you, Lynn. I'm always reachable through acimblog.com and on Facebook with the same. And I'm actually getting closer to assembling all these links that you've been recording and I've uploaded, and I will make a massive list of over a year's worth of our recordings for people to go through. And next week we can resume our reading from Gary's fourth book and pick up on that again.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
I do appreciate you, Minister of God.
So mutual. And everyone who's joining us today, too. Thanks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bless you all. I love you.
And have a great week, all.
All right. Bye-bye.